Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. As we do at the beginning of every year, we sort of look into the future. We're not prognosticators here, but we do try to identify some of the hot spots to watch. One of the things that we've been writing a lot about recently is what's happening in the South China Sea and around the Philippines like that, Jim. Is that an area that we're going to continue to need to watch?
Well, if you were a news director, you would say yes. Because the Chinese have a real sense of, you know, what makes news and what attracts the media. And they are doing all in their power to make it look like a real hotspot. For example, recently there was a big fracas over the fact that Chinese jet fighters and Japanese jet fighters were flying over the Senkaku Islands at about the same time. Now, you know, it doesn't take much to say, oh, my God, all one of them has to do is push the wrong button and you got World War III. But as a matter of fact, if you look at the history of the Chinese over the last decade, as they've been pushing, you know, this expansionism by 100 cusps, as I like to call it, strategy, they are very good at stopping just before they hit the red line. I mean, they're basically playing brinksmanship. But they're doing it from a position of strength. Now, I mean, even the Japanese, the only real thing they have to worry about the Japanese is they'll get them angry enough that the Japanese will develop nuclear weapons. Now, most people are conditioned to think, oh, the Japanese would never do that. But if you're familiar with Japanese media, the Japanese have no compunctions. I mean, they go through all this, oh, we're victims business, you know, every August, you know, to commemorate Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But the rest of the year, they crack jokes about how long it would take, how many months or weeks it would take for them to develop nuclear weapons. So the Chinese are aware of that, the Japanese are aware of that, but basically, that's all the Chinese are risking. The Japanese are the biggest opponents they are facing in these disputes. You know, the Philippines is basically leaning on the United States, and right now, we're saying, well, we'll hang out a little more, but we're not saying, no, yeah, we'll back you up. You know, we'll go in there and fight the bully if our little Filipino brother, you know, gets beat on. We're not doing that. And that's a big issue in the Philippines. You got Vietnam, which is getting very friendly with us and Russia. But again, they've got no guarantees from anybody to basically back them up if the Chinese come in, as the Chinese are saying they're going to do. They're coming in, they're surveying these disputed properties. On some of them, they're basically putting up temporary habitats, you know, on these atolls and reefs. They're coming in and driving piles, and then on these piles, they're putting on, you know, shipping containers and putting a few troops in there and flying in or shipping in water and what have you. Keeping them alive, saying, hey, see, there's Chinese there. They declared most, last year, of course, we reported this, they declared most of the South China Sea as a Chinese province. So you can see where they're going. But on the bright side, they said they had demonstrated that they are not really looking for a war. They're just looking for more real estate.
Interesting. Austin?
Well, I like Jim's description of the South China see, basically saying that they're practicing brinksmanship from a position of strength. The result, and Jim indicated this, I'll bring it together in the political sphere here, is that they have created an alliance of a burgeoning alliance of virtually every nation on their border. I mean, China has. We've covered this on Strategy Page, the developing connections between, get this, South Korea and Vietnam. Vietnam's got a well-trained, primarily infantry army, and we know that the Vietnamese have very capable soldiers, but Vietnam doesn't have the money to invest in new weapons, high-tech weapons and the like. South Korea does, and South Korea builds a lot of its own systems indigenously, or has the capability to do it, and they certainly are high-tech. So what's developed without an overt alliance, but it's something that South Korea and to the light of Vietnam, South Korea has been kind of taking the lead on this, that they've exchanged training groups among senior officers and operational commanders. And South Korea has mentioned that it's discussed providing Vietnam with access to new, well, I think one of the reports was new sensor and surveillance technology. Well, they're trying to help them with intelligence technology. In other words, you've got two fronts right there. For the Chinese, if you look at it as it's a political problem and a diplomatic problem, but you're dealing with the South Koreans and the Vietnamese, you're dealing with two quite competent military establishments. Now, South Korea is not on the South China Sea, but South Korea has made it very clear that it's tired of the way China has used North Korea as a little bulldog. And to rattle South Korea, Japan, and the United States. So South Korea, what I'm saying here, Dan, is that you're rattling the cage down in the South China Sea from a position of strength has also produced a counter reaction within the region, and here's just one of them. The Philippines have. I mean, this is the irony of ironies. Subic Bay was a great U.S. Navy base, but, you know, the U.S. were terrible imperialists and we were bad guys, and so we have to pull out. Well, now the Filipinos are rethinking that when they see the real regional hegemon China coming back and making claims based on some of these charts I've read have references that go back to 8th century. 13th and 14th century, for sure, on Chinese claims to control of some of the, as Jim described them, islands, atolls, reefs, islets. Maybe the Filipinos want to back up with a big friend, and that's the big friend is the United States. You've also seen Malaysia react to China. The one friend that China seems to have is Cambodia, and of that, Cambodia has been more or less the lone, I can't quite call him pro-China, but the Chinese ally out of a group of Southeast Asian nations that feel that they are being, they're being probed and they're being intimidated by the Chinese military and the Chinese government. So, position of strength, yes, counter reaction, and I named two allies, even, you know, South Korea, that you really don't want as an enemy, you know, the two burgeoning allies. You don't want Vietnam and South Korea. What's driving it is, you know, the general media level is all the potential resources, oil, gas, some minerals that can be mined out of the South China Sea seabed, and based on what I've read, is there's a trove of these valuable resources, natural resources there. It's also a component that does crop up a little bit. We talk about it on strategy page, is the Chinese nationalism. Pride in China, part of that is also driven by the concerns back in Beijing that China's still several Chinas, and they're trying to forge a national identity, so it's useful to have enemies that you can push around or opponents to push around, but you could turn them into enemies. And Vietnam for China. You know, Chinese are very, very powerful, but Vietnam is not, they're no good enemies, but Vietnam is certainly not one to have on your border. And that's, So I'm not predicting a Chinese-Vietnam War. I'm just showing you the way that what the setup is for incidents. So
yes. Now, one of the things that you've written quite a bit about during the last year, Austin, is Greece. Now, normally we don't look at political types of things unless they involve conflict, but is Greece something to watch for, to continue to watch
if you look at, I mean, go back and look at some of the things that Jim and I, you know, collaborated on in Quick and Dirty Go to War series. We always had something in there about Greece to show you the evolution of it, the NATO southern flank, which is, you know, Greece and Turkey. That, you know, as the Cold War fades, that, but you still had, because of our real deep and embedded interest in the Balkans. I mean, Greece is a Balkan country, and that certainly was conflicts of the, you know, the Yugoslavia's wars of devolution or Balkan wars, and, you know, Greece was sitting there, and we understand that Greece had claims on what it called Northern Epirus, which to the Albanians was part of Albania. And there's, you know, still a little tussle that goes on between Greece and Macedonia, even over the Macedonian name game. But there were a few more serious kinds of confrontations involving Greece. And we started covering these. They were over the Aegean Shelf between Turkey and Greece, and also Cyprus. So Greece has been, and Cyprus is a frozen conflict. It is one that has resonance with a lot of bad history in southeastern Europe, and it all moves into the Middle East as well. I mean, Cyprus is just right off the Lebanese coast. Just take a look at the map as well. But it's and everybody knows a little bit about my own interest in both Greece and Turkey. And my last book was on Kemal Ataturk, and a significant amount of that was on the Greco-Turk War following World War I. Cyprus and the Aegean Shelf to Greeks and Turks recalls the Greco-Turk War of 1921-22, and even older conflicts. I mean, there are still a number of Greeks that think Istanbul is Constantinople, which it really is, except the Byzantines still ought to be running. Now, that may sound strange to some folks that are listening to the, you know, elements of the mainstream media for their coverage of conflicts, but for a lot of strategy page readers, it's not. It's certainly relevant to at least some of the extremist factions in Greece and Turkey. Now, the reason I went through all that, Dan, is that you can go back to our files and see why we have covered Greece, both in the Cold War context, but also all these other, the Balkans were a huge problem, the Kosovo War, in 1999. Greece's economic situation, Dan, is in, it's, I'm not the only person saying this. There are a lot of other folks out there. You know, the canary in the coal mine, the canary in the canage, the gas leak that's going to asphyxiate and kill everyone. I mean, Greece's economic tragedy is indicative of the kind of problem that faces not simply Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland to some degree. The Irish are digging their way out of it, but potentially other nations in the Eurozone, ultimately the U.S. And you don't have to look very far to track the relationship between extraordinary economic disruption, especially such a significant disruption that you have impoverish large elements of what have been your middle class, to see how that leads to internal violence, potential civil wars, border wars, are larger conflagrations. And I'd say, well, why, hey, Austin, why don't you just come out and talk about Weimar and Germany? Okay, but there's there's a game that Jim's company Simulations Publications did, and Jim designed it, that is called the Empires of the Middle Ages, which is a fabulous game. And you play about 650, 700 years of history from Charlemagne to really 1453 the Constantinople, notionally in this. And one of the strengths of that game is the economic component. You know, you don't get the economics right, and some of these things start happening in your little province, much less your empire. And for folks that have played more modern games, to some degree, SimCity or some of these other things that I know that's a two or three generations back in terms of computer games, but it's, what are you doing to make money? What are you doing? Well, and things start falling apart, and that has political effects. And take a look. In Greece, you've had a revival of militant unionists who were, Dan, they were all along hardline communists. And you've also had a revival. There's now a Greek Nazi party. Well, as Al Nopi will tell you, there are always a strong Greek fascist with a big F component, ultra-nationalists, in line with what you call the ultra-nationalist groups that you see throughout the Balkans. But Nopi and some things he's also written will note that often in terms of internal violence, guerrilla activity, that there's no difference between whether they were a brown shirt or a red shirt. And Greece is a country that is in extraordinary political turmoil. It's been challenged, riven by terrorist activity. Some of it was communist terror activity during the Cold War, designed to upset Greece as a NATO nation. But you're seeing some of the terror now, whether they were communist cadres or even just potentially organized crime, now takes on the facade of attacks on quote unquote the big banks, attacks on Nazi interests. What they mean by that, they mean Germany today, which has been the bankroll the excess that the Greek government splurged, spending, the Greeks were spending money they didn't have. They were being supported by essentially the French, German, working public, and the taxes there, the Dutch is, and the Dutch. And of course, but the ultra-nationalists and the communists flip that and saying that, we're being torn up again by German invaders. Well, they're playing on a World War II theme there, and the Germans can't win, even when they're providing the economic capacity for the Eurozone. But the point of this is the Greek radicalization and the economic situation produces a very fragile situation. Now, we pointed out several things that Jim's written as well as I have about Greece's situation, is that it's really much weaker militarily. All these submarines that we're going to buy can't afford them. They're having to sell stockpile or get rid of weapons, ammo. They just can't. They can't keep it. Can't keep it up. So that makes them less likely in one way of getting into a fight with Turkey or anyone else in the region. At one level. Another thing is, though, is that also weakness, unfortunately, can be as much a cause for a conflagration. Someone says, "I'm going to take advantage of Greece." Would that happen in Turkey? I don't think so, but you can't write the possibility off. You can't write the possibility off that certain outside factions might try to take advantage of Greek military weakness and Greek internal weakness, whether, you know, the rot of the Greek military. So that's why we cover it. Is it going to be a problem in 2013? Dan, we're still going to be covering this in 2018 in some way, because it's Greece is making some small progress with its austerity program, but it is so deeply in debt. Even look, the last thing I read was you might see a real improvement by 2015. If you go back and look at either the last one or the previous Balkan update, you will see that the Greek government was talking about 2014 and the fall of 2012. So it keeps, you know, the time horizon for real economic improvement keeps going further and further into the current decade.
Yeah. Jim, one of the things that keeps popping up in the normal or the mainstream media is the Falklands a little bit. Argentina continues to shake her sword. Is there anything really there? I think I know the answer, but I thought I'd ask you.
No, there's no there. It makes a newsworthy subject because the 82 war 30 years ago was quite spectacular. But the basic problem is that the Argentines have done very little to upgrade their inadequate armed forces of 1982. So while the British have shrunk their armed forces, they have maintained their technical capabilities and their, you know, their training. And so let me put it this way. The Argentinians cannot make the type of attack they made last time. They haven't got the aircraft, they haven't got, you know, the ships. They're weaker than they were in 82, and the Brits have a larger garrison on the Falklands and have made it clear to the Argentines that, you know, you saw what the nuclear submarine did last time. It sunk a cruiser. Well, you know, we can do it again, and we will. You know, so it's all, you know, smoke and noise. There's no fire there.
Right. And it goes back to what we sort of talked about last week, which is that if you want to watch some of these issues, dig into the money issues, because really the saber rattling is going on because of the Argentinian problem with their economy.
Well, now that's true. There are two things going on there. One, yes, it's the same old story. In 82, it was a military government, unelected government. This time around, it's an elected government that has made itself, you know, very unpopular for corruption and incompetence. And the economy, as last time, is a mess. But the second factor, which was not present in 82, is they are exploring for gas and oil off the Falklands. And it appears that there's some stuff there. That's money. Could be billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. And that's worth fighting for. The problem is the Argentinians have nothing to fight with. So they're making noise, hoping that maybe there'll be a miracle. Maybe the UN will come in and yada, yada, do this or that. But speaking of these imaginary wars, the big problem with 2013 or any new year is that there are so many old wars that just won't stop. For example, in Africa, where most people have been killed, you know, since the Cold War ended, due to the influx of cheap AK-47s, and of course the eventual collapse of a lot of the socialist governments that arose, corrupt and socialist governments that arose when the colonial powers left in the 50s and 60s. This was no surprise to anyone. I mean, people were seeing it in the 1980s. I know Austin and I, you know, were covering this in the first edition of Quick and Dirty Guides to War. It was visible even then. But then when the Cold War ended and you can no longer play the United States and Russia off against each other, and all your pipe dreams and spending your, you know, your capital, as it were, caught up with you, and everything started to collapse, this basically caused a lot of countries to go into a state of, you know, civil war. And the problem was, while most countries in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, got religion, as it were, and went democratic throughout their dictators or, you know, generals and what have you, they still had the corruption problem. They still had a management problem. You know, there was, they didn't have enough competent administrators to really, you know, fix themselves. Now, some did better than others. I mean, you have dozens of countries down there. And, of course, you know, just as there's always a caboose on every train, there's always an engine. And there are several countries down there that are doing quite well. The problem is the countries that are doing quite well are not the largest countries, namely South Africa and Nigeria, who are doing very poorly. Both countries may be edging towards some kind of civil disorder or civil war. Nigeria is closer because they're basically divided 50-50, between Muslims and Christians. And, they have a Islamic, radical organization, blowing up people and killing and shooting people up north now and have for the last few years. It's not huge like in Iraq or even the Taliban, but it's persistent. And the other problem is that even countries that where peacekeeping has worked, where as we describe it, people just got tired of killing each other, and peace has arrived, it's not a hard peace. In other words, there are still enormous problems with corruption, tribalism, and what have you. And a lot of the countries are ready to slip right back into civil war. In fact, you have flare-ups, sometimes fairly significant, like in Ivory Coast. We had taken Ivory Coast off the rotation, as it were. It was there for years, but we put it back on recently because there was a flare-up. There were bombs and shootings and what have you, because the people who technically lost the civil war were back. Now, they were put down, but they're still there. And you'll see this all over the world. I mean, these are what we call endemic wars. They exist in the Pushtun territories. For the uninitiated, those are the tribal territories of Pakistan and southern Afghanistan. These are areas where the Pushtun tribes, about 40 million people on both sides of the border, predominate. And they have been fighting each other and everybody else for thousands of years. I mean, that's as endemic as you can get. Indeed, they even caused the Hindu Kush Mountains to be named the Hindu Kush, and in Hindi, Hindu Kush means just the Hindus. Yeah, that's basically the Pushtun attitude towards all those people living on the lowlands. Even though most of the ones adjacent to them are now Muslims, but they used to be Hindus. They have long memories. The problem there is you need long-term solutions for these long-term wars, and these long-term solutions really aren't coming. They're not coming quickly. And a lot of people in these countries get this first. That's why so many, you know, fairly ambitious and bright people from these countries try to get to the West. I mean, first of all, you have to realize they have money. It costs money to pay smugglers and what have you and bribe people to get out of there. These are people who could stay in their own country and live a fairly good living, but they're basically despairing of ever rising above this chaos. You know, the death rates, the crime rates are much higher in these countries. In fact, there's a new book, God help me, I should have remembered the name, where a guy did a study of tribalism, something I've known for years, and most anthropologists have, but he quantified it. He says, you know, you're much more likely to die from violence in a tribal society than in a non-tribal society. Well, hello? Anybody who served or worked in Afghanistan will tell you that. You know, forget Detroit, you know, New Orleans, you know, and places like that. Go to, you know, Central Africa or Somalia or Afghanistan if you really want to see, you know, a short lifespan, guaranteed. Because these are extremely violent parts of the world, and they have been for time immemorial. This is nothing new. You know, a lot of, academics like to blame it on colonialism. Well, Afghanistan was never colonized. Actually, Afghanistan has been walked over by some pretty powerful empires, but they all left because there was no there. You know, just a bunch of, you know, testing Pushtuns, and there's no money. Like I say, follow the money. And if there's no money, you know, just walk away. The only reason people aren't walking away from Afghanistan now is the Afghans, and the Afghans are split on whether this was wise or stupid. One group of Afghans, the Taliban, offered sanctuary to an international terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda. Now, if it hadn't been for that, you know, the Taliban might still be in charge. Actually, what would be happening in Afghanistan, there'd still be a state of civil war. Because what a lot of people fail to realize is that when we went in and Johnson won, the Taliban had not yet conquered all of Afghanistan. They'd been working on that for about 7 years at that point. And if we had, if Al-Qaeda had not been given, you know, refuge and basically had stayed out of there, we would have stayed out of Afghanistan. We would have suspected us that it wasn't terrible, but it would have always been on the last page of the newspaper, if anywhere at all. You know, nobody would bother with it. But you host international terrorists, you get some attention. Now, a lot of Afghans say, well, this is a good thing because the GDP has skyrocketed more than 10 times, you know, since 2001, and most of the money has come from foreign aid. Now, a big chunk of the money, maybe half or more, the numbers are not hard, comes from the drug trade. Something else that was imported from Pakistan, Burma. But anyway, the heroin trade and the foreign aid has made a lot of Afghans rich. Now, what a lot of them do with their newfound wealth is try to get out of Afghanistan. So you can see what kind of really, you know, tough problem you have in parts of the world like that. Problems that are not going to go away. So if you want to see what the big wars are going to be in 2013, just turn around and take a look at what the big ones were in 2012.
Right. Now, one of the things that has popped up recently on the radar, Austin, is Mali. And what is going to continue to happen there?
How old do you think that war is, Dan?
You know, probably a long time. No, part
well,
of
no, I'll just tell you, I realize we're running on time, so I'll try to keep this tight. But I'm going to pick up on something that Jim was saying, and I'm going to add a personal note with this. I taught my first class of the semester yesterday, a strategy and strategic theory class. I teach in an honors program at the University of Texas. And one of the first things I have students read for next week is Sallust's Jugurthine War. And it's about Jugurtha's rebellion at the end of the second century B.C. and the Roman attempts to put down his guerrilla war. And I asked any of the students in the class, and there were, you know, like this, they hadn't read it, but anybody would know what Jugurtha's ethnic background was. No, well, he was a Berber. And I did ask, and the next question was, are there any Berber rebels out there today? Got the answer back from this. Well, I believe in Mali, yes. Well, okay. Now, I'm not connecting Jugurtha directly to the Tuareg in Mali, but the Berbers argue that they still have their own language and identity, despite being overrun by, attempted overrun by Romans. I guess we'll have to include Goths, Vandals and Goths. Arabs,
even Carthaginians.
Carthaginians. They had handled Jim. They absorbed them, right? They'd get recruited. You know, they would supply some of the troops and mounted troops for them as well. They'd get recruited, but the Carthaginians don't fit into it like the Romans. Well, they did the Arabs. They may be overwhelmingly Muslim, but they are not. They resist Arabization, didn't get overrun by the Turks. Turks were nominally in control, and they've been successful in flipping domination by the French, to some degree the Italians. The Berbers live in, you know, southern Libya and the like. Anyway, I didn't go into all of this in the class, but see, the Tuareg still have that Berber tradition, Berber identity, their ethnic identity. Yes, they do share Islam with a host of people, a small number of whom are members of Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, who are their nominal allies. It's an alliance of convenience, because the Tuareg, for the most part, yes, and I, in a column I wrote this week, I talk about, the Ansar al-Dineh, or I believe that's, or I've also heard it pronounced on the radio, Ansar al-Din, the which is a Tuareg radical Islamist militant slash terrorist group. They're kind of the go-between between AQIM and the rest of the Tuareg. But the Tuareg rebellion, they live in northern Mali, which is not too different from southern Algeria or southern Libya or the like. In other words, it's a Sahara Desert. Sahara Desert as it begins to taper into the Sahel, which eventually tapers into the jungle. And they say that southern Mali, where the capital, Bamako, is located, and it's the Muslims run it, but they're black African Muslims of a different tribe. They say, you know, they're attempting to subordinate us and dominate us. So the Mali's Tuaregs, some of them want an independent Tuareg slash Berber state. Some of them are interested in getting the same kind of autonomy guarantees that Tuareg Berbers have in Niger, which is right there in the same region. And West African diplomats and French diplomats, but some of the West African diplomats, it's into Jim was talking about Nigeria. Nigeria is split in half. I think Nigeria's war is new. Hey, look, Biafra was big, guys, in the 60s. It's not new. That was a primarily Christian Igbo rebellion against the Nigerian state, which they thought was being too much controlled by Muslim tribes from the north. Well, the Nigerians want to keep Al-Qaeda and the likes as far away as they possibly can, and even though it's still several countries away and a long distance in the minds of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb strategists, you know, Nigeria is the big play. So you see Nigerians' political and diplomatic interest in keeping the radicals as far away as possible. So you have these West African diplomats who've been trying to get the Tuareg, primarily the Tuareg separatists, you could call them secularists, to make a deal with the Southerners and force the Southerners to make a deal with the Tuareg to give them the same kind of regional autonomy that the Tuareg and Niger have. I'll tell you what, a lot of it, in my opinion, Dan, would be simply, you know, political boilerplate, because it's hard as heck to get the Tuareg to do anything, anyway, unless they want to, because of the nature of the terrain and where they live. But of course the alliance of convenience has succeeded to some degree. The other problems that Mali has had. I mean, Mali was a democracy, wasn't it, Jim, 6-7 years ago? I mean,
yes.
And then of course the military military overthrow, and there've been a lot of issues, instability with Mali itself. Big point out of this, Dan, is that the Berber identity, Berber desires for autonomy, the Berbers have made deals. Now, there are plenty of Berbers in Algeria. In fact, there are some Berbers, a couple of websites out there, you can see where they argue that, you know, Algeria is really a Berber state. Well, they make a case, but they're speaking Arabic or French. There really are a lot of ethnic Berbers in Algeria, but that plays an important role in what the Tuareg want politically for themselves, and because of ethnic issues with the Southerners. And also here, the Tuareg have a legit gripe too, which is they say that the government in Mali is endemically corrupt. Guess what? It is endemically corrupt, and they feel cheated. They want fair guarantee of, if you're going to have projects, we get some projects too, you know, in our lost corner of the country. This goes on in virtually every country in the Sahel region. I could say, I guess, sub-Saharan Africa to some extent. I can think of exceptions in places where the ethnic identity component, translated as tribal component, is, you have dishonored our tribe. Well, you've cheated our tribe, and that becomes the one of the causes for the kind of conflagrations that Jim was describing, as, you know, the Africa's this continual simmering low-grade war that sometimes moves to a higher-grade war. And Mali has moved to a higher-grade war because the French government decided to act to blunt, really, on Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb thrust into the south. It became more or less, from what I can, what I've read, had aspects of a conventional attack where airstrikes and highly mobile light infantry or wheeled and infantry units would be effective. As a matter of fact, I wrote this in my column. I see the French is trying to buy time for the diplomacy to peel the Tuareg separatists away from their Islamist militant allies and split that split those forces. Jim's also noted that, too, that the Islamists have made the same mistake that the Taliban did, and what some of these guys have done in Somalia as well. They start enforcing these rigid interpretations of Sharia on tribes that you know, that's not their version of Islam, and then they do it at gunpoint. They've also desecrated shrines, many of the Berber shrines, in some case, recognized Berber and Malian Muslim clerics. But some of these were also from back in the pre-Islamic Islamic days, and so they've committed the same kind of horrors that the Taliban did when they shot up all the Buddhas in Afghanistan. All right. So anyway, that's the rundown on Mali.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's like Jim said, you know, the coming year we're going to be watching the things that we've watched over the last year, and we haven't talked about Syria or Libya or Egypt today or Pakistan, but those we know will all continue on, and so it's going to be the same thing over and over again, and that will keep us in business, I guess.
Unfortunately, and until next time.
Yep, next time. Bye.